Hey, welcome to the Scott Mann Podcast. Whew, man, we got a hell of a guest today. Alicia Perk Perkins is going to be joining us. I'm going to read you Perk's bio. Perk is a former law enforcement officer and Army combat veteran who was severely injured in Afghanistan when an improvised explosive device destroyed her vehicle during combat operations, and the blast killed the other vehicle occupants, and it jettisoned her body, causing lower body injuries that have left her with metal hips, femurs, and right tibia. As a result of the blast, she is also a cancer survivor of breast cancer and is currently undergoing rigorous and brutal treatment for colon cancer. Despite all of those injuries and her recovery treatments, Perk has remained dedicated to serving other veterans as a peer mentor and as a founder and lead trainer of Pop Smoke, which is a 501c3 nonprofit that assists veterans in getting service dogs. And the full name of it is Pop Smoke Canine for Veterans. And again, it provides veterans with service dogs who are suffering, the veterans who are suffering with PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and MST, along with other high emotion injuries and conditions that come from combat and service. So, you know, this interview, man, I tell you, Perk is one of those folks that when our through line is human connection, and you're just going to see through this, like what she dealt with in isolation and then how she found her way back into the light and the power of human connection at different people in her life and how they showed up and how she showed up for them. It's just whether you served in the military or not, I encourage you to just lean into this and just really listen for the threads of human connection throughout it. Now, the other thing is we did a really cool pairing with her and Dan Jarvis. And what's amazing, if you look at Dan's story of getting wounded in Afghanistan, the survivor's guilt, law enforcement and veteran, Perk, law enforcement and veteran, the survivor's guilt that came with it, and how both of them are putting themselves into the world now to give back and to serve. It is so powerful and so needed. And the Patreon behind the scenes that we did with them at our house around the old green egg barbecuing, and them talking and riffing on what it takes to stand up a nonprofit that serves veterans and first responders and what they've learned along the way, man, it is so powerful. You got to check that out. So if you just go to the Scott Mann page on Patreon, you'll be able to see the behind-the-scenes gathering of Perk and Dan Jarvis. So without any further ado, let's jump in and let's hear from my buddy, Alicia Perk Perkins. See you on the other side. Welcome to the Scott Mann Podcast, where we connect like our lives depend on it. All right, everybody. Got my buddy Perk here with us today. And this is a really, really special episode for so many different reasons. You'll see why shortly. You guys know a lot of what we talk about on here with the podcast and what we do at Task Force Pineapple and all of that is around advocacy and telling the story and human connection. And Perk represents all of that. So welcome, buddy. It's good to have you here with us.
Thank you, Scott, for having me.
Yeah,
really,
of course.
Appreciate it.
I mean, you and I already started getting all sobby and stuff looking at the wall of honor.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, boy. But, I mean, honestly, like, When I talk about things like that, like the wall and what, you know, how I found my healing or continue to find it and through storytelling, you know, sharing that with someone like yourself who has run the miles that you have, that it means more than anything to be able to, because I know you get it.
Yeah. I didn't expect that when I come in here, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah.
And standing there in this room with that is an honor.
Well, but, Thank you. So, you know, we're going to get into a range of things. We're going to talk about all of the amazing work that you're doing on the service front with service dogs and what that looks like. But, you know, I think that there's equally or even more lessons to be learned just in your journey and in what you've experienced in your life, particularly in your journey through the military and coming home and all that's come with that, you know. And I just wonder, and I'll kind of let you, you know, you pave the way on that. But would you mind sharing your story from the point of origin that you feel comfortable and telling us kind of how you got here.
Yeah, for sure. I would do that. You want me to do that now?
Absolutely.
For me, I think the day that my life changed was we'd been out on a 5-day convoy to change some radio towers up in one of the mountains that had went bad. And we were on our way back, traveling through Death Valley. And
this was in Afghanistan.
It was, yeah. And we'd actually had like 5 or 6 already. I ran the IED. I call it the signal machine. Yeah. There's a way more technical names for that. But and it had went off 5 other times during the trip. So it was working good. And we were going along. I was in the passenger side seat. And I just remember we were all laughing and having a good time, like trying just to get through it. We were all exhausted. You know, we just wanted to get back and get it over with. And then all of a sudden, I remember silence. And then I woke up 500 feet from my truck. We ran over an IED machine, or an IED. And I still can't. The biggest part, I think, of my trouble moving forward is I can't remember, like, did I miss the signal that it was, you know, there? And the guilt that come with that for me is something I don't think I'll ever move past, because I'll never have an answer, like, if it did or if it didn't. I woke up 500 feet, and I'm really confused about where I was and what was going on and what happened. And I tried to get up without even looking at myself, and nothing moved. And that's when I looked down, and I had been pretty much blown apart within my pelvis. I could see inside. I could see my bones. I could see everything inside my pelvis. And I was bleeding really badly. And then out of the blue, one of the other guys from the truck pulled me underneath their wheel well because we were taking fire. And he said, here's your gun. Use it if you need it. And I just blacked out shortly after that. And then I woke up again when I was back on the helicopter being taken back to the FOB. And so they can stop the bleeding just to try to get me to transport back to Germany to get surgeries and everything to see if they could save it for me. Yeah. I did not know if at that point if anybody in my truck survived or didn't. I just assumed that they were getting the same things that I was going through. Like, why would I be the only one that made it out of that? But it turns out I am the only one that survived. They told me that about 6 months after I was still in Germany having surgeries, and they thought it would not be a good idea to tell me so soon. So that's the reason they waited as long as they did, because then that's when, like, I started questioning things, and that's when they finally told me that the only reason I survived is just the way that the IED hit the driver's side. It chucked me through the turret, and that's how I am the lucky survivor, I guess you could say, of it. So I was in Germany for about 6 months after that. I never went back to Afghanistan after that. Like, they sent my stuff, and then they sent me home to have 6 more of my surgeries. I had to get a new pelvis. I have a new pelvis. I have a new tibia and fibia. Those were all completely obliterated from just the blast of the shock waves of it. And then the TBI that I received from it, like, has literally changed who I am as a person and how I have to operate my life. These are all just things that...
How so, Perk? Can you talk about the change of, like, how the TBI has shown up for you?
Yeah, it shows up in a lot of rage in life, and then memory, pains of migraines that are just sometimes just, you just can't function off of those.
Did they know early on? Because, you know, or, you know, so what year would that have been?
2011.
Was that your first deployment?
Third
deployment to Afghanistan. Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize that just the number of deployments that a small percentage of the population did. But, you know, 2011, they were still kind of figuring out the whole TBI thing. Did they know early on, or was this later that you kind of figured it out? How did that work?
Yeah, they didn't diagnose me with it right away. It was later on when I started complaining with the headaches, the severe anger and rage issues, and just, like, I just couldn't make sense of anything that I was doing. Like, I just stayed in a constant state of confusion, nothing, like, and then the frustration from the memory issues, all that kind of played into par. And then that's when they started doing the scans on my brain.
Yeah.
But I guess if you think about it, being shot through a turret, you're bound to have something happen to your head.
My goodness, yes.
Yeah. And then landing so far away from, and the landing had to have, I mean, even though I have no, memory of it, it had to have been hard, even though they say sand is soft. I don't.
Not at that.
I wouldn't think sand is that soft.
No. So you went to Germany first, and then back to the United States. Walter Reed.
Yes.
And that's where you ended up. And can you talk a little bit about that phase? Because I know that had to be. I don't know how many surgeries you had, but it was a bunch.
Yeah, altogether to this day, I've had 13 leg surgeries.
13 leg surgeries.
Yeah, to put me back together. The last ones, so that everything worked. Good, were just knee replacements to connect it all together.
And I mean, I don't know that we've ever talked about this, but I mean, it's astounding. Like when I watch you walk and how you, like, I mean, I know there's, I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
When I watch you walk, like it's, you've clearly put the work in.
I was determined not to live my life in a wheelchair or a walker. As I tell you, I was going through these surgeries, and I spent a lot of time in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And I didn't go out much. And so I remember going to the mall one time in a wheelchair. And, you know, I was younger, and everybody thinks that you're younger, you don't need to be in a wheelchair, there's no reason. I actually had somebody come up to me and say, "What are you doing in that? You don't need to be in that." Just from looking at me, you couldn't. I'm in clothes. Right. You know, you can't see the physical scars that I have. And that day was the day that I said, I'm not doing this. This is not going to be my life. Yeah. I'm not going to be judged from a chair.
Yeah.
And like I had options. Like they said, your options is this or we can amputate.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that for me either.
Yeah.
Cause I just really couldn't imagine my life without my legs.
Yeah.
And so I fought hard and I pushed. Until I pushed until they gave in, because I wasn't going to stop it. And I did so much therapy and anything under the sun. I researched anything to get me to the point where, okay, yeah, if I can walk with a limp, I can live with that.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I have hard days. I have to go back to a cane. I have to go back to a walker. I can't walk long distances. I have to use a scooter. And then if I'm in a house with stairs and I'm using them quite often, I have, we had to have a chair put in that would take me to the top. But other than that, like, and dealing with the pain, I've learned to function completely again.
Yeah.
It took a long time. It wasn't right out. Like I had to learn to, cause I don't have feeling on certain sides of my feet. So I have to make sure I'm touching the ground and feeling it in order not to stumble.
Well, there's a fall.
Yeah.
Happens.
Yeah. I did that a lot. Yeah. I looked like, you know, not real smart sometimes, like going along and down I went. So it took a lot to learn things again.
Yeah.
And then when your brain doesn't work right, it makes it a little bit more difficult too.
And it hasn't even at this point, like it probably hasn't been diagnosed, right? I mean, early on,
right.
Like you're going through the recovery and things are happening and you're like, you're not even sure what it is, right?
Yep. Yeah.
You know, my buddy Romy Camargo, I don't know if you saw his episode, but he's been in the chair where you're sitting, and, you know, he's a quadriplegic ventilator dependent injury. And, you know, he but very similar to you. Like his attitude was, in his case, it was, you know, the chair was what he was confined to, but yep. he didn't accept the fact that he would never get out of it, you know? And so he petitioned, he and Gabby, the undersecretary of the army, and they changed the policy to go to Portugal and get stem cell surgery because you couldn't get it in the U.S.
Wow.
You know, yeah. And it's just, it's astounding to me how hard folks fight to recover. Not always, but someone like yourself, how hard you had to fight for the right to recover.
Right. Yeah.
The way you wanted to recover.
Yeah. They just wanted to take my legs from me. And that was their answer. Cause that's, to me, that was the easiest path.
Yeah.
I mean, and it may have saved me a couple of surgeries here and there. Right. But what would my life been, you know, and I just couldn't picture that.
Yeah. 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 So when were you eventually discharged from Walter Reed?
At the end of 2012 is when they dismissed me from there and then med boarded me out of the military.
Okay. And how are you doing at this point? Like, what's going on? Because, I mean, that's a lot, man. You know, and with the med board, you're not exactly leaving the Army probably the way you thought you would leave the Army.
Yeah.
What's happening there?
I had a big loss of self. Like I knew that it was time for me. Like, this wasn't my role anymore.
Right.
You know, I knew that it was going to happen to me, you know, but I just didn't know like what is me now? Like who am I? What am I capable of? I didn't even have the same loves for things. Like the world looked really different to me. Stepping out from those gates of those bases and everything that you had learned over the past 8 years was
your whole identity.
Yeah. They really shape you into a different person when you join the military, you know, and then figuring out how to come back to being a civilian and what did that look like for me and all the things that I enjoyed, I couldn't do anymore.
Right.
That was all part of me. And I had to figure all that out. And I had a lot of anger. But then I think a lot of veterans, when they get out, they're like, they block that dark side. And they're like, oh, I'm just out here having fun and everything's great. Yep. And then and one day the darkness set back in again. And it's when the world got super dark. And all of those issues that I had locked away and was trying to pretend was good. Wasn't good anymore. You know, I couldn't go out of the house. I spent almost 10 years of my life, in my home. It's the only place that I felt safe. And during this time I did get married and we had decided to have, to adopt a kid and, it really fell in our lap. The kid thing did. Literally I was contacted by a person I went to high school with and she was like, I work with this lady whose daughter had a son in Florida, which is where I was at the time, and 2 hours from you, and the mother just walked away and left the kid at the hospital and they were looking for someone to adopt him. And so he came into our life and here I was, a person that couldn't leave my home. I couldn't drive past a trash can.
Because of what might be under it.
Yeah, because I do know that the IED that hit us was buried under trash. A big pile of it, and which is very common back then, is how they hit them.
In fact, when I was interviewing Dan, you know, the IED they hit.
Yeah.
And he was talking about in all the interventions that he's done with trauma. So many of our community, of our peers, to this day, it can be a triggering event just driving by roadside trash.
Yep, it absolutely is. I would start to go out the driveway. I can't tell you how many times I jumped in a vehicle and tried to go down that on trash day, and I would just put it back in reverse and back right into the garage again and just said, I can't do it. Not today. Today's not it. That's not today.
And those days started stringing together.
Yeah, until 10 years passed. And I was standing, every house that we lived in, I always built a bar my friends joked, as soon as you build a bar, you're going to move again. That's what they always said. I built a bar, and we'd been at this house for a long time, and I had gotten to the point where my world was super dark, and I was not participating in my son's life whatsoever. It all fell on my wife at the time. And I walked out to the bar, and I had a gun in one hand and a phone in the other. And I looked at the gun, and I looked at the phone, and I said to myself, which one? You know, look for help, or just take all the pain that you're feeling and let it go. And at that moment, my wife and son came out the door, and I chose the phone, and I started scrolling that day looking for help to get me out of these walls. And I've never looked at that gun since. I keep it. I don't use it. I keep it locked somewhere from, I guess, my soul. I guess I have to keep it locked somewhere that I just don't want to remember that day, because I had reached it to where I got tired of feeling alone. Nobody understood you. They looked at you like you were crazy because you couldn't leave your home, you know. And I knew that I was letting my wife down, who had married me, really, honestly, when I was at the point where I had blocked everything down and I was pretending that the world was good. So was it fair to her that I went into this dark place, you know? And I knew that probably if I didn't figure this out, divorce was around the corner for me. And I started trying to figure it out then. I should have started out earlier. You know, I might be divorced now, and that's okay, because I knew that her life was definitely rough with me in living that way, and I couldn't expect someone to sit there through it as rough as it honestly was. And so it hit hard, it was tough, but I still continued that journey of healing. Like, I went, actually, my first thing was a couples thing that we did just to, so that she knew she wasn't alone, and that was actually like the biggest eye-opening moment for her, because I think she saw that I don't think this is going to get much better, honestly. Right. And that was a pushing point for her ultimately in the divorce part of the things. But for me, it was the first time that I said my story out loud, that moment.
Did she know it?
No. I never told her much of anything. She knew I had the injuries, obviously, because the scars are pretty severe. But I never told anybody until that moment, honestly. My parents knew very little. They didn't really know until after that event that I sat down and told my parents everything that had happened to me. And, I mean, they knew that I was injured, obviously, and that kind of thing, but they didn't know the backstory to it and everything.
So was this like 2020, 2021?
Yeah, somewhere about in there.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you started to share that with the therapist, the couples therapy, and it sounds like the marriage just couldn't last.
Yeah, it was, just because I went to something, I think everybody thinks that you come out of there and you're all of a sudden healed.
Yeah.
Right. But it just takes a lot more pushing and a lot more help from everybody around you to keep moving forward with that information that you get. And so the next step from there, I went to a program for warriors. It was a warrior retreat, and it's 7 days. And you go there and you kind of like learn different ways to handle those dark moments. And, you know, some of the things I didn't resonate with, like I'm not very good at the meditation because my brain really doesn't allow me to do it. My brain's kind of like a Rolodex. It never slows down.
Yeah.
And it's just going through one traumatic event over and over and over and over again. So that I couldn't ever get there with that. Actually, I tried to meditate and it would make me throw up sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I gave that one up, and the one that actually really stuck with me was nature and grounding yourself back into that. Because I grew up on a farm. I grew up fishing.
Yeah. West Virginia?
Virginia.
Virginia.
Right on the border of it. Yeah.
Okay.
And I grew up riding horses. That was a huge thing for me as a kid. And getting back into that, man, that just felt really good to, like, finally, for the first time, I felt like I could breathe.
Mm. Was that when you maybe, was that the first time that you started to actually feel some degree of hope on the other side of it, or that maybe there was something else other than what you had experienced?
Yes. Yeah, that was absolutely the moments where I was like, okay, they don't have to always be this dark all the time, and I can feel like I have momentum to keep pushing forward. And because I had lost a lot of that at that moment. And it was, and then I just really dove into the nature thing. I really just started spending as much time as I could outside. I even catch myself laying in the middle of my yard. Like it's one of the places that I find the biggest amount of peace for myself.
Yeah.
You put the phone down. You don't have anybody. You don't have to talk to anybody. There's nobody asking your questions or hounding you or anything. And I make that a part, whatever it is, whether I lay in the middle of the grass or I go somewhere, I'm walking in nature, whatever it is, like, I take that moment, it's mine. Yeah. And I don't do it with anybody. It's me, and just trying to still figure out who me is.
And I think, you know, one of the things I try to talk a lot about, in Nobody's Coming to Save You, is this, you know, I call them micro resets, but these, like you're talking about, getting out in nature, getting grounded, putting the phone up, and just reconnecting with the natural world.
Yeah.
Like that alone.
Yep.
Especially if you're breathing.
Yeah.
You're conscious about your breathing, I mean.
Yep.
That can have some pretty powerful effects. And not just, and it's not unique to combat wounded or service members. Like, that's for anybody, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a game changer for me, just realizing and remembering how powerful nature can be.
And how healing.
Yes. Like, it's
restorative.
It settles my soul, like, every time same. I do it.
I feel that way when I go back to the mountains.
Yeah.
You know, and same. I know we've talked a lot about it. Yeah, I think where you and I differ is I am going back there as soon as I can. Like Bilbo Baggins at his birthday party. Like, I am going to freaking disappear, and that's where I'm going.
Yeah.
You probably will not go back there, but do you get that restorative feeling when you get back in the mountains and kind of – you're around it, do you feel grounded, or is that a special, is it still a sacred place for you?
Oh yeah. Like, I have a friend that has a cabin up in the North Carolina mountains.
Yeah.
Actually right where they got hit.
Yeah. That's where my family's from.
Yep. And so I've been up there since I've been on, I call it my healing journey, I guess you want to say.
Yeah.
I've been up there for hiking. They have some incredible hiking that leads to great waterfalls and stuff up in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, that is, literally the place that when I got diagnosed with colon cancer and I was going through a divorce right at the same time, I went there. I shut the world out for 2 weeks. I didn't actually stay at the cabin. I lived in the woods for 2 weeks. I'd take little breaks and go back into civilization so people wouldn't think I was weird, kind of thing. But I'd go to a hotel and stay at night just to get a fresh shower and do those things. But I really just... I had to figure out if I was going to fight this thing, the cancer thing, or if I was just going to let it ride again, because this is actually my second bout with cancer at that point. And so like being there in the woods, I still go there and I still do, like, I can't even express to you how freeing it is to be there.
Yeah. I'm so astounded by you, Perk, because like you just said, going through a divorce, my second bout with cancer, and you said it as casually as like, I'm going to go get a drink of water. I mean, and it's one of the things I love about you is, you know, the way in which you navigate this, there's just such a level of acceptance, I think. And I know that's not always the case, but can you talk, I mean, so you, the marriage didn't make it, but then there was not one, but two diagnoses with cancer. As you're still recovering, like you're still healing from the combat injuries, right?
Yeah, it's like, it's almost like the world wasn't done throwing me some more torture. It's kind of like the way it felt like. So I got breast cancer first, and I had a double mastectomy. And I just had to go through chemo just a couple of times for that one, just to make sure they got everything, and one bout of radiation. And then a few years later, I find myself being diagnosed with colon cancer. And I can't help but think that the reason, like, cancer has got me a couple times is because of the amount of shrapnel that was actually in my body, especially in the areas where I've been affected by cancer. Yeah. I was covered in it. I still have effects to that. Like, most recently, I had to have a surgery for the bone that actually was shrapnel had went into, and I had to have that removed from my thumb. So I can't grip things and stuff like I should for that. So it still plays a part in it, but there's literally no way I can prove that because of what I went through, I have this cancer. But yeah, so having it again, the colon cancer thing has been a ride, you know.
Well, and there's just an alarming rate of cancer in our generation of warfighters.
Yep.
I mean, it's profound.
Yes.
And yet it's kind of, it almost feels like the Vietnam generation's Agent Orange,
yep.
Where for the longest time people just called them crazy and rolled their eyes and, mm-hmm. you know, all this bullshit. And then come to find out, yeah, the defoliant caused massive amounts of cancer.
Yes.
And I think the same is true here. Like, you know, looking at what our folks were exposed to, certainly that level of shrapnel in your body, but there's really no way to prove it, is there?
I mean, it just makes sense to me. Like, if I put it in front of myself, I'd be like, what
How
brought
else
this?
Would you explain that?
Yeah, because actually colon cancer, they say, is very hereditary.
Yeah.
But nobody in my family has
no
colon
cancer. No history of it in your family?
None.
So you're still going through that right now. You're still going through, because, I mean, all of this is pretty darn recent.
Yes.
Right? That you overcame the breast cancer, divorced from your wife, and then you get... You get slammed with another bout with cancer, and you're going through this one on your own.
Yes. Yeah. And still trying to be a parent to a 5-year-old. It's difficult.
Yeah.
I don't get to see him as much as I, but just because I just can't, I don't have the energy level to do it. So I get him like 4 days every 2 weeks, and that's the days that I have to relate to my son. And I always try to make it where he doesn't know that I'm sick, because I don't think a 5-year-old needs to go through that. So, like, I have bad throw-up days. At this point, I've lost 80 pounds with the chemo. It's just not been fun. Like, I'm a shell of a human most days.
Yeah.
I always say I feel like ass in a can. that is an accurate statement for me. It's truly, like, the energy level is just not there, but I don't know quit.
No, you don't.
My mom rides me a lot. She's like, you need to stop. You need to rest. You need to take those days. And I do take those days, but I don't. She thinks I don't take enough of those days. But I tell her that if I lay there, I'm going to give up.
Yeah.
And I just can't do that. That's not what I want for
That's
myself.
That's not how you're wired.
No.
Laying at your feet there is, you know, a partner, a pal, you know, Toby. And can you talk a little bit about your service dog and... One, what that's meant to you.
Yeah.
And then how did that lead to, you know, the amazing stuff that you're doing now?
Yeah. So I had met a guy that was an ex police officer out in New Jersey.
Which you had a background in law enforcement before the Army as well,
I did.
In St. Pete.
Yes.
Okay.
And he was a dog trainer. That's what he did in the police force. He was a canine guy. Yeah. And so he moved down to Florida. And one of the things he wanted to do was to help as many veterans or first responders kind of have a path into this dog training thing, because it's actually really good for your mental health.
Why is that?
I honestly, it's just like being around an animal that completely understands you, I think, has been the most changing moment for me.
Okay.
They don't judge me for anything.
Yeah.
They love you unconditionally. And in a world where you feel like you can't trust, like a stranger tried to kill me. If you think about it,
yeah,
they didn't know me. All we were there doing was trying to help, and they tried to kill me for it. And so why wouldn't that relate back to my home where I'm at now? And so I feared everybody. Like, I didn't trust a soul. I had a very small circle, and the trust within that circle for me was very lightly. Yeah. Like one wrong move and I'm out. I can't do it. You know, my trust is gone for that. And then, so he entered, he's like, listen, I think his name was Nelson. And he's like, I think a service dog could change your life. Mm. And he would always come to, cause he knew I couldn't leave. So he would come to my house and we started that journey of him just teaching me how to do it. And so at night I would scroll looking for a dog and Toby's face popped up.
Were you resistant at first?
Or no, because I was really, I needed something. Yeah. And I was so open to trying anything to see if it would work. Like I knew that I couldn't live the way that I was living anymore. And so I just started looking at pictures and Toby's face come across on a Facebook thing. He was a failed duck dog. And so I reached out to the guy that had posted his picture because he was in discussion. And I told him who I was and what I wanted him for. And he said, absolutely. And I contacted an organization called Pilot for Paws, and they flew him to me from Missouri.
Yeah.
I met him for the first time at the airport on the, what do you call those? My mind's going blank.
On the conveyor belt.
No, like when they fly in their tarmac, that whole thing. I actually was able to go out.
On the tarmac.
The little small little planes that he flew in on. He was in the back seat and he come out and he immediately came to me. There was three or four other people, but he came straight to me and our bond started that moment.
See, I felt like I had a connection last night when you and Dan had your service dogs over with Toby, and I didn't realize it, but with him failing duck dog training and me failing ranger school twice, that's what it was.
That's what it was. Yeah.
And we're kindred both recycles.
Spirits. Yeah.
So anyway, so you guys meet on the runway and then where does it go from there?
We immediately go home and I start doing everything for him. I start training him using everything that Nelson had trained me up to that point. And he worked me through it, made sure I was doing everything right with him. I literally did everything for Toby. I cut his nails. I groomed him. I bathed him. I fed him. I gave him permission. Like as he learned, he had to get permission for everything. So he had to get permission to drink water, to go to the bathroom, to play with a toy. Those are all things that I had to learn how to do and to get him to learn how to do. And it was a long process. It probably took us about a year and a half to really get on.
The purpose of that giving permission? Like, what is that? Because the dog is on duty, right? Is that why that is?
Yeah. They have to look to you for everything, you know? Mm-hmm. So you're their leader and you want them to be paying attention to you all the time. So that is another way to get them to focus on you is that they're looking for you for permission to do things, whether it be when I tell him down, he looks at me and I'm like, down. You know, I have to give him those commands to do it. He's looking at me. No one else can do it. But I did teach my son to do a few things with him.
Yeah. And was this, I have to think this was super helpful for you mentally as well, just for your own mental headspace as you're going through that.
Yeah. It finally gave me purpose.
Yeah.
Something that I didn't have anymore. I felt like a huge failure up to that point. Like, what am I at this point? Like, there's nothing for me that I can do that would make me feel any different. And then I started training him and our bond and our love got together. I was like, I changed. Like, I think I smiled for the first time that I hadn't smiled in probably 10 years. And it was just a moment where I felt like, whew, there's hope here. I can get out of these gates. I think I can do this.
Wow.
And it was a thank at that moment. Still a thank.
It could be a light. It could be a train. But I'm relatively sure it's a light.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then our process went on for about a year and a half of training. And then I finally decided to take my son for the first time to daycare. And that's my first time outside the gate.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was that like?
Scary. It went about 5 miles an hour. And then it went really fast. And then I went back down to 5 miles an hour. And I finally made it out of my community and to his school. I got out and boy, it's chaos in those daycares on drop off time. I was like, why did I pick this moment? Yeah. Right. Yeah. But it was a true test for me. If I could make that moment, I can do it again and again. And I went from there. There's this little small coffee shop that I would go to. I literally went there every day, drop my son off. And they had this room in the back that they actually reserved for me in the back. They wouldn't let anybody else go there because kind of like when I went in there the first time, I was like, where can I go where nobody else can come? Yeah. And like, they were just, it's just a mom and pop local coffee shop.
Those are the best.
They are. They make the best coffee and the best.
Yeah.
And I went to that room. They saved it for me every morning, same time, same channel. And I did that for over a year.
Wow.
And that was about as far as I went for a year.
I mean, there's healing in that too, right? That's its own ritual.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You're incrementally moving back into the social connections and that piece. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And so.
So I had a routine again.
Yeah.
You know how we're so routined.
We're regimen driven. Yep. And it's so important that we have a rhythm like that for what we do. Yeah. Yep. And the rituals that populate it.
Yep. Absolutely. So once that started kicking in, like my drive started coming back into it a little bit. And then. And then one day a buddy called me up and he said, I'm coming to your coffee shop. You still going to be there? I said, like clockwork. You know? And he showed up and he was talking and he has a service dog. And he said to me, he said, I think you should start one. And I said, start what?
Yeah.
And he said, a service dog organization. And I said, absolutely not. That's going to be me putting myself in front of a lot of people and meeting a lot of people that I don't know, which
I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm good. Like, I'm just going to sit over here. Me and my dog, we have our space. We're good. And he said, well, just think about it. And I said, okay, I'll think about it and I'll let you know. And I went home and I just brushed it up to my wife. I was like, what do you think about that? And she's like, only you can answer that question, you know? And she said, but if it's what you decide, you know, I'm support it. And I didn't think about it again. I dropped it. And then I went back to that coffee shop the next day, and guess who showed back up? This time he didn't give me a warning that he was showing up. He just showed back up. And he said, so what are we calling it? And I said, what are we calling what? He said, the service dog organization. I said, literally, it's not even been 24 hours since you put this in front of my face. And like, I don't have an answer yet. And he said, let's just brainstorm. What would you call it if you did it? And
that's clever.
Yeah. He's a man of words. And I said, honestly, I don't know. And we went through some stuff and I said, and I just thought for a minute and I was like, you know what? What about Pop Smoke? And he said, well, tell me the story why you would want that. And I said, because the day that I was medevaced out of Afghanistan was the day that my life changed that moment. That incident changed the projection of my life. And I think that if I'm going to do it, I would want the name to mean that this was the day that I was going to change somebody else's life.
And for those that don't know, when they call in a medical asset for evacuation like that, it's oftentimes difficult for the chopper to orient on where they need to go. And we carry smoke canisters. And so one of the things that will often be coordinated between the ground unit and the pilots is a command pop smoke.
Yep.
And that smoke comes out and it signifies where to come for the extraction. And in this case, to fly you to the next level of medical care.
Yes.
And so in that sense, pop smoke on that day propelled you into a whole new world.
Yeah, it saved my life. It got me out of there and got me to a place for care. You know, I would have bled out if I'd stayed there for very much longer.
100%.
Yeah. And they got there quickly. They were able to get me back to the FOB and get me to stop bleeding enough to transport me. And that moment was why I think that name fit to what I wanted to do.
I think that name's brilliant. And I you know, the geek storyteller in me comes out when I hear that, because, you know, the brain, and this is something Dan and I were talking about in another interview, but about how the brain works in patterns and it uses metaphors. You know, to make sense. It has a mandate to make sense of the world, and it uses metaphor to make sense. So it tells itself a story. And so that pop smoke, I mean, once you know what that is, like, it just makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
It literally transfers, because I think what I hear you saying is that, like, the same way that you pop smoke and they were able to extract you from that life-threatening situation, now a service dog can be that same pop smoke metaphor for a veteran or first responder that's struggling.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
write that down, Colin. That's really badass. And okay, but you played the game, you gave the name, but were you bought in yet, or are you still?
I was not bought in yet. Nope. He's like, I think that's the name. Like, he was like really going on it.
And he knows he's got you at this
point. Oh, he knows. He's like, I got her to give me a name. So
you're done.
We're in it, right? I went home that day and he texts me like nonstop for like hours. What are we gonna do it? Are we gonna do it? I'm like, I need to like swallow this for a minute. Yeah. Like, I need a minute to really figure out if I'm capable of doing it. Cause I mean, I'm literally new out into the world. Obviously, I put my foot on pavement that I hadn't been on in a long time.
10 years.
Yes. And I was like, I don't know if I can just throw myself in. I mean, I didn't know that helping others was something that was driving me.
Yeah.
I was still busy trying to figure out how to help myself.
Yeah.
You know? And what it turned out to be for me, when I finally said the words, all right, I'm going to do it. And I sat down at the computer and filed for the nonprofit, did the SunBiz thing with Florida, did all those things, and told my wife I was going to do it. And I had help coming up with the business plan of it, doing it all and putting it together. And that's when it all started, I guess
you
could say.
What were you feeling, like pure terror at that point?
Oh, God, yeah.
Because we talked about this last night, about just that, I mean, that's another thing you and I have in common, is that, you know, we started a nonprofit from nothing.
Yeah.
And it's not easy.
No. God, it's been a whirlwind. There's been many a times I'm like, what am I doing, right? It's hard to get people to know what you're doing.
Yep.
It takes a lot of your own money to do it. And you're doing it. For me, I'm doing it because it's actually a therapy for me.
Yeah.
But it's also a way to help people that are struggling. Veterans are struggling.
You know, I think about your buddy that helped you, that pushed you.
Yeah.
You know, and I went through a very similar thing with the dark point in my life, where I came very close to taking my life. And in fact, a family member saved my life unwittingly.
Yeah.
And I think about the friends that came to my aid afterwards when I finally decided to get some help and you know, just look at my mental challenges in a way that was not a victimhood but just hey man, this is what's going on.
Yeah.
The people that came to my aid and the way in which they came to my aid was so amazing. And it was like what you're talking about. It was like this peer-to-peer type thing, but it wasn't, man, it wasn't even up for fucking discussion.
Yep.
Like it's like let me tell you how this is gonna go.
Yeah.
Right. And I'll never forget that, you know, and like I'll never and I like to think that I try to mirror that now and how I navigate the world. But what does that mean to you? I mean, human connection is a big thing on this podcast. When you look back on that intervention, because that was an intervention.
It was.
Of the highest order.
Yep.
Of the coolest variety.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean to you now when you look back? You know, what would you say to that buddy on this?
Thanks for saving my life. Because it changed me. It gave me a true purpose to feel like I wasn't a failure anymore.
Whew. And man, you were off to the races at that point,
yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah, like, I was in it. I don't know any. I don't know how to do anything half-assed, as they say.
I mean, I think it's a good thing.
I think so. Yeah.
You know, but like then on the other side is like it can also just run you into the ground. But I'm the same way. I don't know any other way to run.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm grateful for it. You know, I mean, for me. If I skid this car in sideways and that's how I leave this world, you know, like that's what my dad's doing. I mean, he's already told me. He's like, man, that's how I'm going out.
Yeah.
I'm skidding the car in sideways. Yeah. Don't be putting a friggin' blanket over my legs and shit.
Yeah.
You know, because he's like, then I will die.
Yep.
You know, I just don't know any other way to run. And I think it's all right. Yep. What do you think?
I wouldn't have it any other way, honestly. The other option for me is sitting there and laying.
Just stewing in it.
Yeah. And that makes you miserable. It makes you miserable and it makes you not want to be here.
So when did you open Pop Smoke? When was it like open for business?
In 20 the end of 2022.
Oh, wow.
2023, summer's right in.
Yeah. All right. And so you're living in Florida.
Yeah.
And how, what was like the first, what was it like to train the first service dog and provide that dog to a veteran? Like, what was that experience like?
Well, we went through this whole, you know, when you start a dog thing, getting dogs donated to you doesn't happen like right away.
Yeah.
Like you have to prove like your training is good. And so we bought our first couple dogs for the veterans. Okay. And
you had to go through a lot of training yourself.
Oh, yes. Quite a few years within that. As I'm still learning, he's still, you know, even when I started Pop Smoke, yeah. Nelson played a huge role in me, even though like he actually passed away during COVID. He got COVID and he actually didn't get the vaccine, but also didn't go to the hospital soon enough when the breathing thing was an issue. And he was like passing out at that point. He just waited too long.
So this is the gentleman that helped you start the.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was a really rough moment because, you know, a really great guy and really helped transform me.
But what a gift.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, damn, what a gift, man.
Yeah. And so his wife still has all his books, training books and stuff. And she gave me some of them.
Oh,
and
wow.
Yeah, so it helped transfer me forward with the service dog portion. And then I just added on to it. So I went for medical alerting training because medical alerting actually, if you were to go and say, hey, I need a medical, it costs you anywhere up to $40,000.
Wow.
And I couldn't say, here's a dog, but you'll have to go pay $40,000 to get the medical alert. So we raised $4,000 and sent me to school, and now I can do it for free. And that made much more sense to me than the other way.
Which, by the way, I want to plug it now. So Perk is training my dog,
yep.
Murph. Apparently, I have not met Murph yet, but he and I share a lot in common in terms of energy levels.
Yes, you do.
And I'm just astounded at because one of the things that you asked me was, like, you know, what are the things medically that you want me to pay attention to? And I thought, holy crap, like, you know, that's amazing that you're able to do that. And so you basically went through the certification to do that so that you could provide that in addition to the service animal, but that specific function as well, because so many of our veterans and first responders are going through that.
Yeah, like the anxiety is that I can give you a dog that will make you feel comfortable in public, and that's really good, right? But what if I could give you that dog that they smell your anxiety, because it's all about a smell for a dog, and we all have a scent.
Yeah.
And I can give you a dog that smelled that, and they can come up and apply body pressure to you at that moment.
Yeah.
Would that change the way you felt about that moment?
Absolutely.
It changed mine.
And I think the thing, too, is, you know, one of the things that I'm not crazy about, Perk, is the way that our civil society, particularly Vietnam onward, global war on terror, a lot of the ways they portray veterans, you know, is this victimhood,
yep.
You know, broken individual who needs this dog because life's over,
yep.
You know, and what I've tried to rail on for years and, you know, we do at Pineapple and with this podcast is that, like, we're talking about some of the most high performing people on the planet,
yep.
Right? You're mm-hmm. talking about people who, like, young privates first class that are thrown into rural villages and deal with human situations that could make most diplomats spit up a hairball,
yeah.
Right? And they're in there engaging. And then, you know, you think about you getting blown out of a turret,
yep.
You know, 500 feet from a vehicle, and then back in the game and doing what you're doing here at home. Like, of course there's going to be anxiety. Of course there are going to be things that need to be overcome so that you can get back in the game and lead at the high level that you lead, that you've always performed at. You're a high performer, you know, and I know you get uncomfortable me telling you that, but you yeah. are. You've always played at a high level. And getting back to that, I think a lot of people don't realize that a lot of what this is about helping veterans, first responders, lead us again
yeah.
and get back in the game.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people that have some major awesome qualities and they just can't get out of it. They can't take that one step to push forward again.
Well, you know, one of the things that Dan talked about, you know, being he in Afghanistan, IED,
yep.
lost one of his guys.
Yep.
And the Survivor's Guild. I have that as well, you know, yep. And he described it as an 800-pound gorilla.
You know,
like it just stays on your shoulders all the time. And, you know, it's not about veterans sitting around going, oh, poor pitiful me, or law enforcement officer, you know, feeling sorry for themselves. It is an actual thing that stands between that individual getting back in the game or not.
Yep.
Right. And it's very real.
Yeah, okay.
And these kinds of modalities are the way that we pave the way to do that.
Yep. Yeah. So for me, like, I didn't realize how the knowledge of knowing that no one else survived from that truck would actually dictate the rest of my life. Like, for the longest time, I didn't want to lead anything again. I had so much guilt ridden, and I still do. I didn't get to go to their funerals. I think I want to approach their families one day if I can get there. I do have some of the items that were still left from their bodies that I don't know if I can ever let go of, I think. But that moment, I think, as hard as it is to sit there and say, like, I survived and they didn't, I think I survived for a reason.
For a reason.
And that's been hard to accept.
That's a long journey to get to that point.
Yeah.
I'll ask you this question right now because I think it's the right time to ask you that question based on what you just said. With all of that in mind and what you just said about maybe understanding the why of this now, who is Alicia Perkins?
I'm a fighter. I guess that sums me up. I have no quit in me. I'm a human again, and I didn't feel that for a long time. The blood was still pumping in my soul. I still had the body parts. But I didn't have the soul to go with it anymore.
Yeah.
But now I do. For the longest time, I didn't feel empathy towards anything. I had a lot of hate and anger. Anger and rage still is a part of me right now. I'm really trying to get on the other side of that part. But, yeah, so if I had to sum it up, is I'm human again. And that's a really good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's amazing watching you, you know, the fighter part, model that. You know, one of the things that I've been astounded with, like your battle with cancer this time around, and good Lord, the chemo.
Yeah, it's been rough. It really was my second time with chemo, but the first is just a couple. I didn't realize how much chemo changes everything about your body, how it functions. Like, I'm on my fourth pair of glasses in a year. It's changed my vision so much I actually just recently, when I get home, I have a bigger phone to try to be able to see.
Yeah.
Because I, like, misspell words because I can't see the keys, even though I got glasses, but because it's just changing so rapidly.
Yeah.
And with the VA, you're only allowed to get one pair of glasses a year. So, like, when I have to get a second pair, like, I have to fit that bill. So I always like, do I want to fit that bill or can I just live with what I got, you know?
And so many veterans are dealing with that, some version of that, you know, I want to just take a few minutes and talk about that, veteran advocacy, right? Because it's something you're passionate about.
Absolutely.
Matt Williams is passionate about, Dan Jarvis is passionate about, I'm passionate about. I know a lot of people watching this are super passionate about this.
Yeah.
But then I also know that there is a large number of people, and I'm going to riff for just a second here, but there's a large number of people in this country, and God bless them. Like, it's not malicious.
Yeah.
But they have no clue. They just don't understand what was asked of a small percentage of our population for 20 years, you know, to go fight in a war, in both Iraq, Afghanistan, and other rough places. And it was the same people over and over. You did three tours. I did three tours in Afghanistan. There's people did a lot more than that.
Yes.
You know, but what amazes me about this, Perk, is that, you know, we're 20 plus years past 9/11, 2001. You know, my son, my oldest son was three when the towers fell. He's now a captain in the infantry.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And so we are at this place now, I believe, where the global war on terror is over. You know, we've got new threats out there, some old threats out there, but that phase is over.
Yep.
And we're in this place now where, you know, 1.8 million GWAT global war on terror veterans are going through these different things, some more than others. But the fact that I keep coming back to is that these are high performing people. Like this is, these were people who volunteered multiple times.
Yep.
Many of them to go into places that most of the world didn't even know about. Right. And I'm really grateful that for 20 years we could muster so many thank yous for your service.
Yeah.
I mean, I really am. Like, that's awesome. And it's certainly better, as my Uncle Jerry reminded me, it's better than the yellow, you know, the dog shit that he got hit with
yep.
when he came home from Vietnam. I actually had someone at one of the plays tell me that it was a lie that they didn't throw dog shit at Vietnam veterans.
Oh, really?
Can you believe that? Yeah. That they quoted some study? I'm like, all right. But the point here is that we're 20 plus years into this thing. I think we're beyond thank you for your service. I think we're beyond here's a blanket. You know, like it's really, it's leaders like you who went over, did what you did. You're working to come home and you have more to offer. You have more to give and you're doing it.
Yeah.
But some things happened when you were fighting cancer alone this second time, living in a subdivision. And I think for this, we'll leave it kind of like the actors' blocks. We'll leave it to the actors' imaginations on the details. But I think the story is important
yeah.
because on the advocacy front, I don't think people necessarily realize what some veterans, first responders, and their families are going through as they fight to come home.
Yeah.
Like, and this isn't some sob story. Like, you are doing service dogs
yep.
with Pop Smoke. You're not taking a salary.
No, I'm not.
Right? And you are fighting colon cancer at the same time.
Yes.
By yourself, living yes. in this subdivision.
Yes.
And you've got a kennel. And how many acres?
Five.
5 acres, and you're operating a kennel. The yes. kennel's back off the property.
Yep, in the back of it.
And what starts to happen?
Just
however you want to come into this, hopefully I set it up enough to let
yeah,
you roll
you
with
it. Yeah,
you
did good. I lived in a HOA community.
Yeah.
And I had a kennel.
In Florida?
Yep. Which they gave me the right to put there, yeah. right? And then once it got there, they started making my life a living hell, so to speak. They would fly drones over my house. They came onto my property without my permission. And then they decided they were going to take me to court to get me to remove it. Even though there's 25 other businesses there in that community, they never gave that. Even my next door neighbor has 9 businesses that he runs yeah. out of his house. One of them is that the general public comes in, rents these trailers, takes it, fills up their landscape shrubbery, brings it back, and he burns on his property.
But in the same neighborhood.
Were they right next door to me.
Where they served you, what did they serve you with?
Court papers telling me that I had a certain amount of time to move my kennel. And then they were going to take me to court.
So this is when we got, connected. And Task Force Pineapple
yep.
Jumped in and started working kind of the advocacy piece.
Right.
But I mean, at first I didn't believe it. I was like, there's no way.
Yeah.
You know, but come to find out that that was the case. And now you're looking at court. And by the way, I had written a letter. I wrote a letter personally.
Yes.
To the HOA leader saying, look, let's try to find a solution here. Like, this individual is, you know, combat wounded, gravely combat wounded, doing service animals for veterans and first responders, not taking a salary. It's a 501c3.
Yep.
And is going through chemo as we speak. Yep. Like, can we find another? And what happened?
We still went to court. and then I got in front of a judge that she was basically like, I forget what she asked me. And I was trying to explain like, hey, I'm currently going through cancer. She actually rolled her eyes at her desk deputy down there. I didn't see it. My parents was there and some other people that came to support me rolled her eyes at me for it. And she didn't want to hear anything else that I had to say and gave me 3 months to move my kennel. Actually, she was going to give me 30 days. And I asked for if I could have a little bit longer because I am currently going through chemo. Like, that's not something that I have the energy to do right at this moment, you know? And reluctantly, she gave me 90 days once she cleared it with the other side.
Yeah.
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 And then turned around and told me that I was going to have to pay for their lawyer for it.
And, you know, I would love to say that that is an isolated incident.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't believe it is just in, because when we tour with the play,
yeah,
you know, we do talkbacks all over the country.
Yeah.
And so we come out on those actors' blocks and we sit with the audience after the show and we just talk.
Yeah.
And that kind of story comes up every single time, every single time, some version of that. And sometimes it'll be men and women will wait around until after the talkback and they'll come and share stories like that through tears because they're too embarrassed to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Perk. I mean, I guess my question to you is, I mean, you through all of that, you, I mean, those were some serious down times that we had.
I don't think I've ever had that amount of stress. Not even the day that my life changed.
Yeah.
Like it was hitting me from every direction. Divorce, cancer, and then the HOA thing.
Yeah.
Like I just couldn't take another step. Honestly, I didn't know if I was bound to go pick up that gun again. I was at that point sometimes, like I just couldn't see a light.
I remember texting with you and talking, and it was, you know, you were looking at packing the dogs up and being done with that.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it was dark.
It was dark for me.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I say this because to the HOA members and the judge, you know who you are, right? And you got to live with that, right? But what I would just suggest to people is that. And this is not just for veterans and first responders, but, you know, all of us would probably do well to realize that there's always more to the story than what you see.
Yeah.
Right. There's always more below the waterline happening. And that person that, you know, appears to be doing X or Y or Z, there's usually a story behind it. And, you know, if we can just dig in a little bit and find out what that story is, like there's a lot more there. And I think so the tragedy in all that is, it could have been avoided. Like it was complete in my mind. Like there could have been a much better outcome, but it did work out.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I could have understood it if my dogs were causing a chaos, right. But I train service dogs. They don't bark.
Right. And it's like back off the property. I mean, like
it's way in the back. It's away from all the houses. Even if they did bark, you still couldn't hear it. And they would still call somebody that lived way away from me, that still in the community, would call animal control just to be bullying. Animal control would come out, sit by my gate. They sat there for 10 minutes, and then they called me. And they said, we've been sitting outside your gate for 10 minutes. There was a report that there was dogs barking here. And she's like, we haven't heard one in 10 minutes. And she said, we've blown the horn. We've done everything to activate it. And I said, yeah. I said, I'm being bullied and harassed at this point. And basically they said, if any more calls come in, we're just not going to come out. We're going to call you and let you know. And that way you can use it for later. Because it is bullying. It is harassing.
So what did you end up doing?
I made the decision that I was going to leave, which was a hard one. And I found it very difficult to find another property to go to because special exemptions in Florida, certain counties have them. And those special exemption committees only meet every 6 months. Mm. Well, I had 3 months to move a kennel. I didn't have 6 months for me to buy a property, wait for you to give me a decision where I can move my kennel there. So my options were find a county that I could just move right into it and didn't have to have it. And I found one in Live Oak, Florida, 2.5 hours from my son. So I have the HOA to thank for pulling me away from my son. But I made it work. So I move it out there. I'm literally in the middle of nowhere. I don't have a neighbor for 10 miles. Pine trees are my neighbors. No HOA. not even close to an HOA. And I'm in a town that is super veteran friendly.
That's a novel idea.
Yeah. I remember when I went and looked at the house, was super close to Veterans Day, and we got off the highway and driving through the town, and I would say for 20 miles, this road was lined with crosses of every veteran that had lived in that town. You know, and you go to a lot of towns, and they're a mile of it, right? But no, I went for at least 10 miles, and they were still going.
And I don't think there's any harm in this. What was the city and state where this was?
Live Oak, Florida, and it's in Suwanee County.
No, but I mean, but where all the...
Oh, the HOA and stuff?
Yeah.
Ormond Beach, Florida.
Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Flagler County was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your biggest, I mean, through all of that, what did you learn about yourself? I mean, because there's a lot there, and I'm sure there's stuff you're still unpacking. I know I am. I'm wrestling with different things.
Yeah.
Trying to bring grace to it.
Yeah.
But and I'm also thinking about it from an advocacy perspective, because I worry that that this is happening, this kind of thing is happening.
Yeah.
And again, it's not like this whole notion of the troubled veteran, like, because I'm always keen to pay attention to that, because it's like that's such an easy stereotype, just like any other stereotype in the world. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we send young men and women like yourself off to fight these wars. You encounter the horrors of combat. You come back to civil society. I believe the civilian population has it is inherent duty and has been for tens of thousands of years for civil society to help our warriors come home and to reintegrate back into society so that they can perform at the level that is worthy of their service, but also just worthy of their humanity.
Right.
You know, and I feel like we've just outsourced that to the casual and uncomfortable. Thank you for your service.
Yep.
You know, and it's to me, it's just inappropriate. I mean, I don't know that the term is inappropriate. I'm still wrestling with that. But 20 plus years, you know, and a 20-year war, that's where we are.
Yeah, that's what we got.
That's what we've got, you know. And when it comes to advocacy, and I look at, like, the moral injury that was inflicted on so many of our veterans after the collapse in Afghanistan.
Yep.
You know, and I'm telling you, I've looked at this since then. There hasn't been a commander-in-chief even acknowledge the service of our men and women in Afghanistan, either party, since that withdrawal.
Oh.
You know, like in a meaningful way.
Right.
Or acknowledge the impact. I may be wrong about that, but it feels like there's been just almost a turning of the page.
Yes. You know? Forgotten.
Yeah.
For sure.
And that just, one, it's deadly to veterans and their families. But two, it leaves us here at home, it leaves us with a void, because these are men and women that really are very contributory and have a lot to offer in many cases. And we're missing that, you know, because we're not standing at their shoulder. You know, one thing I'll just say, it's interesting contrast as Toby gets comfy there. a buddy of mine did he did his thesis on veteran transition.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that his finding at the end of all of it, I asked him, like, so what did you, he was a long study. And he said, you know, really what I came away with, Scott, my thesis is most veterans don't need therapy. You know, what they need is a sincere connection with their neighbor.
Yep.
They need to have their stories heard without judgment.
Yep.
And then they just need to walk that path of healing with their neighbor at their side.
Yeah.
And I thought, damn.
Yeah.
But that certainly doesn't sound like the place you lived in Florida.
No, no.
In any of them.
Any of that. No, it was, I mean, like, they, I started selling my house at that point. I even had people calling my realtor, telling her this stuff, even though my realtor knew everything that was going on. But that's a breach of, it was another realtor called that realtor. That's actually a breach of her contract as a realtor.
Yeah. It's an ethical breach.
Yes. And, like, I didn't even know these people. They didn't know me.
Yeah.
I literally.
Or try to.
No. And here's the funny part. The main people that did this to me would come into this company called Orman Farm Supply. I worked there one day a week just to get myself out from, I just needed something different to let my mind, and it didn't take a lot of me. I just loaded feed into a car. But those people would actually come in there. They had no idea who I was. None, zero. I loaded feed in their car. They had no idea who I was.
There it is.
And it took a lot for me not to say a whole lot.
Yeah. Wow.
But, yeah.
Whole new level to getting below the waterline there.
Yeah.
All right. So what are you most excited about when you think about what's down the road for Pop Smoke and what you're doing? Tell us where you are on your treatment, and also just kind of what's in the windshield?
Yeah. So I have two more chemo of this round. And it has been shrinking. So there is a hope that these are the last two rounds of it. and then I can get what they call a soft clear. And that is a big hope.
Well, big prayers up.
Yeah, because I'm just not really sure I can do anymore. This chemo for a year is just really taking the toll on. I'm tired of feeling like crap. I mean, honestly, I want to be able to smile without being painful.
Yeah.
You know, or pretending that it's there. I really want to feel it.
Yeah.
I'm just tired of it. I need a break. I need a big break from it. But, you know, as in, like, where I'm at and what do I see in my future, like, I think I've said it 100 times, like, I don't care if I help one veteran or if I'm helping 1,000 veterans. I just want people to know how a dog can change your life. It's not a pet. I want to educate the public on service dogs. There is a big lack of that where people, I mean, I went to a flea market very recently, walked up to this table where she sells pet beds, and I was just looking, and she literally tried to climb over the table to pet my dog. And I said, please don't touch my dog. I said it very nicely, and she got very rude with me. Then why do you bring your dog here? And I said, because he's my service dog. I shouldn't have to explain that. There's patches all over him. You should read those. People do not. And then she proceeded to talk to my dog, which it plainly says on the patch, do not distract my dog because he has to pay attention to me. And she literally started calling me every name under the sun.
Wow.
Said that I was being rude because I wouldn't let her touch or talk to my dog.
So this education of the public that you're talking about, you know, you do know that, like, you're the right person to do that, and that's going to involve some storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, Colin?
I get it.
And, I really am seriously excited about the reluctance. Honestly, what I found is that the most powerful storytellers are the ones that are reluctant.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah, I'm definitely reluctant.
Yeah, it's true. There's so much power contained in reluctance because that's where people actually see authenticity.
Yeah.
And so I hope that you'll do that, and I hope that you'll let me be part of that as you do it and your teammates, because, like, you're the right person to do it.
Yeah, I'm definitely passionate about it because it actually is also one of the biggest thing that holds veterans back from getting a service dog is the how they are approached.
Yeah,
in public.
I was reluctant about it. What would you say to that veteran that is reluctant about a service dog, and either that's the argument they're giving themselves or anything else? What would you say?
Yeah, a lot of them feel like when you go out in public, they're all of a sudden they draw a lot of attention to them, which is very accurate. It does. And for a veteran who doesn't like attention, that does not want to be a center of attention, it's rough at first. But it just takes a quick second to explain to that person, like, hey, this is why you're not allowed to pet my dog. But there's been a lot of people that claim their dog is a service dog and lets people pet it. And so it ruins it for the people that actually needs it. You know, you can't distract them away from their job. Like, he has to be able to smell my anxiety when I'm having an attack. Or if a veteran's having a seizure, you distract him and that dog misses it.
Yeah.
That's that veteran's life or that person's life.
Yeah.
Like, I think I posted something and somebody's like, they're not a medical device. Yes, they are. They can go any single place that a medical device goes. That's exactly their job duties. That's exactly what they do. They alert to save someone's life, period. That is a medical device.
Yeah.
That's what oxygen does. That's like a wheelchair does for somebody. Yeah. It gives them access to the public that they wouldn't be able to normally get without it. Exactly the same.
You have a really big dragon to slay with this mission. You know that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm excited for you because it's going to be terrifying. It is. And it's going to be very, very impactful, you know, and those kinds of movements that you're building, you're talking, a 5 to 10 year movement, right?
Yeah.
Of changing the paradigm.
Yes.
On this. But this is, again, when we talk about advocacy, that's what I mean. That's what I'm saying. Like, we are at a place now, we've got to have those conversations. I would also like to see you or someone else talking about veterans whose service dogs reach the end of their lifespan.
Yeah.
Because we are now coming into that realm.
Yeah.
I have a lot of buddies who are contacting me whose service dogs passed on, and they are beside themselves, and there's really no mechanism that they're aware of to get another service dog. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or they're not sure what to do now.
Yeah.
And that's that's a real issue of advocacy that I think we've got to continue to find solutions for.
Yeah, absolutely. Like for us, a lot of organizations I found, they give you a dog and then they disappear.
Yep.
And I want to, I feel like I'm different. A, because I've lived it. I do it. I'm not just a trainer and I'm producing this dog for you. Like I know how it changes my life, but we're always there until the end. Yeah. As long as I'm still living and Pop Smoke's still existing, we're there. I even help other veterans who got their dogs from other organizations that have bailed ship on them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's not something that I can just give you a dog and disappear.
Yeah.
Like dogs go through different stages in their life where sometimes they may need to be retrained or they pass away and it leaves that veteran stuck again.
Yeah.
Like they drift back into that very quickly sometimes.
I've seen it in just the last couple months with a few friends that are like really in that place.
Yeah. Back to struggling where that was their lifeline to the outside world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just a pet. They're really not pets anymore. You know, at that point, they're saving people's lives. And if the public can just grab a hold of what that really truly means, like the understanding of service dogs could change.
I think they are saving lives. And I also think they're empowering a level of thriving. I mean, I see a lot of veterans with service animals, service dogs that are really back in the game doing, you know, big things. So, I mean, I there's that survival piece, but there's also, at least in some cases, where, you know, a resuming of performance based on that relationship that enables them to do things they otherwise might not have been able to do. And we need that in civil society.
Yeah, because you've got all these veterans that are just sitting there locked away with enormous amounts
Tons
of talent.
Yes.
I know of somebody real close to me that has a lot of talent.
I do too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is such an important thing, you know. Through line of this show is human connection.
Yeah.
What has human connection meant to you through all of this journey, from the very painful story you started with until where you are right now, where you're actually looking at a strategic mission that is infused with hope, not without its struggles.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you were to drop a golden thread down through all of that, and that golden thread is human connection, how would you describe what that has been in your life?
Life-changing. I've met some people along this journey that I would have never pictured myself currently being. Like, you're one of them. Being able to actually like connect and carry a conversation with somebody again, and being able to help people understand how dogs, and I guess I hate to say it, like I hate talking about my story, but I guess I've been through something that can help people understand that it just doesn't have to end there.
Yeah.
And being able to reach somebody that maybe just needs to hear it, does something for me. I can't even explain in my soul. A lot of veterans have that, helping others function.
Yeah.
They don't know how to do anything else, but to help, you know, fix things, we're fixers.
Yeah.
And locking those people away and not giving them a way to get out is a bad thing.
It's bad for society.
Yeah, they don't realize.
It's not just bad for the veteran.
What's sitting behind that closed door that could help change the world in many ways.
Yeah, if you don't believe that, look at just an example. Look at what happened in Western North Carolina after Hurricane Helene.
Yep.
I mean.
Yep.
That
was the biggest thing.
I just marveled at that.
Yep.
You know, the fires in West Maui.
Yep.
The veteran response there. I mean, it's and the stuff that's coming our way is not going to be pretty.
No.
We're going to need
that
generation, this generation of warriors and their families.
Yep.
And you're doing, you know, the big work to help them do that. What did we not cover today? Is there anything that you feel like is important to put out there that you haven't, or that we haven't touched on?
No, I think we covered a lot of good stuff from my point of view. I'm not super great at talking, so.
Oh, you're great at talking. Yeah, don't give me that. I would like you to come back on sometime and update us.
Sure, absolutely.
On where things are, like after you do your TED talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seriously, Perk, we love you dearly. Appreciate everything that you're doing for our warfighters and their families and our first responders. You know, you model what it looks like. And I think at the end of the day, when it does go dark at times, just know that, that a lot of us take inspiration from you. I know I do. I know my wife does. You know, we look at you and we look at how you navigate the world and you show us what's possible, you know. And while that makes you uncomfortable as hell to hear, that's the truth. And I'm excited for more and more people to experience that with you as you do what you do, you and Toby.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate you giving me this opportunity. It's an honor, honestly.
How do people support? So if someone is interested in a service dog, number one, and then number two, how do people support you?
All right. Go to our website, which is www.popsmokecanineforveterans.org. Right on that front page, there's an apply button. If you are wanting a dog or if you even want to volunteer, there's that option there as well. You fill out the app, and then we go from there. We start you into the board approval process and that kind of thing. And then if you want to donate, also just go to that website, that same front page. You scroll down a little bit, and you'll see the donation page as well.
Yeah, and look, you guys, I mean, the stuff that Perk is doing and what she's building, you know, this is – she's lived it. She still does. And what she's putting into the world right now, we need it so badly. So if you're looking for a place to make an impact, man, it's a great place to do it. And we'll make sure that we put the website in the show notes as well. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And thank you all for being here today. You know, human connection is a through line in everything that we do, and it's certainly no exception today. So thanks for what you do. If this story resonated, I'd ask you to just share it, you know, share it with folks that could benefit from it. If you know a veteran or a first responder or a family member who's struggling, you know, anybody who's struggling, there's so much inspiration in this story. Someone that's battling cancer, you know, Perk's story in storytelling is what we call a universal singular, in that there is so much power in a personal journey that she's on, that it has universal value. And it will serve so many people. So share it. Put it out there. Invite people to subscribe as part of the podcast. Leave us a review. Thanks for being part of what we do. And we'll see you on the rooftop.